Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm hoping there are some condensed matter theorists in the audience. Great. The short title of the colloquium might be on universality in Fermi liquids, but of course, one of the highlights is also the connection to some mathematical structures that appear in the structure of Z-brains in string theory, so this might be the longer version. And it's much of the colloquium will be actually based on a short paper I wrote earlier this year. So what is this colloquium going to be about? It's, as I said, it's going to be mostly geared towards condensed matter because my only rational, sensible results, technically, that I can present are really in condensed matter. Or you could say maybe there will be some string theory involved, or it's going to be more of the mathematics of K-theory. But again, since this is all based on a very short paper, it feels kind of funny, and it is reminding me of the great Polish science fiction writer Stanisław Lem, who actually wrote books which were fictitious reviews of non-existent books that haven't been written yet. So it's a collection of reviews. So in that sense, I feel very similar. I'll be reviewing a subject which doesn't quite exist yet, the overlap between string theory and actual realistic condensed matter of Fermi liquid. Okay, so, sorry, I'm new to this technology stuff. So more seriously, the structure of the colloquium will be as follows. I'll give you some motivation. Much of the motivation will come from string theory, and I'll also introduce the mathematics of K-theory in that particular context, because it, to me at least, it's more transparent to present it using some simple concepts from string theory rather than just as a pure mathematical formalism. Then the main part will be devoted to hardcore results in actual condensed matter, and we'll speculate at the end about some possibilities of implications to string theory. In more detail, I'll start by reviewing the notion of D-brains, and I'll stress the goal of some fraction of the string theory community, which is to understand better the fundamental degrees of freedom in string theory. And in particular, D-brains are particularly fascinating degrees of freedom in string theory. And we would like to know, first of all, how do you classify all possible charges that D-brains can carry? That will lead us to K-theory. But more fundamentally, we would like to understand better what D-brains really are, and whether they are really exotic string-like creatures, or whether they can be seen in similar but much simpler theories in theoretical physics in other areas rather than in quantum gravity. So, as I said, this will connect us to the mathematics of K-theory, so I'll make the statement that's been known now for some 7-8 years, that D-brain charges are classified by this somewhat mysterious exotic cohomology theory called K-theory. Hopefully the content of that statement will be clear. And then we'll move on to Fermi liquids, and that's a seemingly completely disconnected subject from D-brains. But for me, the motivation was to see whether there are any other areas in physics where objects would also be classified by K-theory, or is it just the craziness of string theory that requires the craziness of K-theory? And surprisingly, the finding is that if you try to solve the goal of, again, some fraction of the condensed matter community, namely to classify all possible universality classes of behavior in a theory which is fundamentally described by some collection of non-relativistic fermions, you surprisingly discover, again, a connection to K-theory, namely stable Fermi surfaces, which I'll define as I go along, are also classified by K-theory. So this will be an interesting hint for string theorists, but also the primary impact of this result should be to conventional condensed matter theory, because now we have a tool for the first time that allows us to actually classify systematically stable Fermi surfaces, which is a problem that, to my knowledge, hasn't been solved before. So I'll spend some time discussing those implications, and then I'll point out again that the similarity of patterns that appear in the classification of D-brain charges in string theory and in classifying stable Fermi liquids is staggering. I have no idea whether the connection goes any deeper, but it's certainly suggestive of some deeper structure. So let's start by reviewing briefly what D-brains are. It feels kind of funny to be repeating this here, because of course everybody here knows, and some people here invented the notion, that D-brains are solitons, which are simply hypersurfaces which I call sigma p plus 1. They are p plus 1 dimensional hypersurfaces in spacetime on which strings can simply end. So cartoons like this you have seen many times before. There are some string-like modes that populate these D-brains, and most people probably know that on these world volumes of D-brains, here denoted by the coordinate y mu, here, you can have gauge fields, other massless fields, scalars which tell you how far apart different D-brains are. You can also have, in the case of unstable D-brains, a Higgs field, which is in string theory typically called the tachyon because its mass squared, when calculated to the leading order in perturbation theory, comes out negative. But it's really just a Higgs field that can condense. For stable supersymmetric D-brains, these Higgs fields would be absent, and this would be a stable configuration described at low energies by some super-Yang-Mills theory. So if you don't look at the world volume of the D-brains, but if you look at the space-time picture for the same non-perturbative solitons, you find out that they actually carry Ramon-Ramon charges, and this was a crucial observation. Ramon-Ramon charges are charges with respect to some higher form gauge fields called C in this slide. Again, these are P plus one dimensional differential forms to which the world volume of the brain couples in the conventional way, generalizing very simply the coupling of electromagnetism to charges. This is all, again, well known by now. And the idea is that these Ramon-Ramon fields C have field strengths that are denoted by capital G here, and they can be described by a nice, elegant space-time effective action, which everybody knows how to write down the leading terms in. The leading term will be the Einstein-Hilbert term describing gravity. There will be some kinetic terms for these Ramon-Ramon higher form gauge fields, and they'll simply involve wedge products of forms and the Hodge dual. In other words, in order to be able to write down this type of Lagrangian, you need to have a metric on your space-time, but you certainly do have a metric because this is a theory of gravity as well. So everybody knows, in other words, how to write down this effective Lagrangian. Everything seems to be fine. And in particular, we would say these Ramon-Ramon fields are just differential forms. So if these Ramon-Ramon fields are supposed to be just differential forms, then we would expect the charges, the lattice of charges of objects that are charged under the Ramon-Ramon fields to be just some simple discrete cohomology theory, maybe the simplest possible version of the Durham cohomology, which I'm assuming people know. And the way in which the discrete cohomology H star of the space-time Y with values in the integers is embedded into the Durham cohomology would define the lattice of charges, the Dirac quantization rules, in other words, for these objects. So this is an expectation that people have held for a long time, until it was demonstrated in the late 90s that this expectation is clearly wrong, and it turns out that D-brains are not just hypersurfaces sigma in space-time, and correspondingly the Ramon-Ramon fields are not just differential forms. It turns out they must be much more subtle objects, and I'll show you the logic of the construction that leads to this conclusion. Instead of being classified by some simple discrete version of the Durham cohomology, they're actually classified, the charges of D-brains are classified by a generalized cohomology theory of space-time, which is known as K-theory. So how does that work? It comes from the observation that you can look at the higher dimensional analog of pair production or annihilation of particle-anti-particle pairs. In other words, you can have brain-anti-brain pair production processes, and again, the conclusion is that brains themselves are not just naive hypersurfaces in space-time, they're more than that. They are objects that carry some extra structure. In particular, each of them carries a UN bundle for n coincident brains, a UN bundle on which the gauge field describing that UN gauge theory lives. So let's denote that gauge bundle by capital E, and that's some extra structure that's carried on that hypersurface sigma in space-time. So you're seeing elements of how brains are not just hypersurfaces, but more of a sophisticated mathematical structure already. And now you can complete the argument by considering a system consisting of n D-brains and n anti-D-brains. And you would say, naively, I can allow the brains to annihilate with the anti-brains. This is technically only possible if not only are they parallel to each other, so they can, in some naive sense, annihilate each other as hypersurfaces in spacetime, but also you need for them to carry the same gauge bundle. In other words, the gauge bundle carried by brains has to be the same as the gauge bundle carried by the anti-brain. Only then can they annihilate, and this naturally leads to the classification of stable brain configurations up to creation and annihilation of pairs. Pairs can be created and annihilated only if brains and anti-brains carry the same bundle, and that defines an equivalence relation on these pairs of bundles. So let's start with a system of brains and anti-brains described by some gauge bundle E1 on brains and F2 on, it should be F1 on anti-brains. And this is equivalent to some other system described by E2 and F2 if and only if they are equivalent up to creation and annihilation of pairs. In other words, there is a mathematical formula in the language of bundles that sits up there on this transparency. And this is an equivalence relation on pairs of bundles. And then, of course, there was a crucial observation by Witten that this definition of the equivalence classes of brains and anti-brains coincides precisely with the mathematical definition of a generalized cohomology theory of spacetime, or of the underlying manifold, known as K-theory. In other words, that mathematical equivalence up there is exactly how mathematicians would define K-theory. So if you can annihilate a bunch of brains against anti-brains, the annihilation sometimes can be incomplete. In other words, if the bundle carried by brains is not the same as the bundle carried by anti-brains, they don't annihilate perfectly, they leave something behind. And the idea is that what they leave behind is the charge of some lower dimensional stable D-brain. So in that sense, the elements of this K-theory group defined up there on the first line of the transparency are classifying possible stable brain configurations. And you can go with the world volume of the brain on which you consider this bunch of bundles, you can go all the way to a space-time filling system. So the K-theory group that classifies brains is then not a K-theory on some world volume sigma of some brain, but K-theory group on the entire space-time manifold X. Okay, so now that we've discovered that K-theory is actually relevant for classifying possible D-brain configurations, what is K-theory? K-theory, as I said, is a generalized cohomology theory. It satisfies some mathematical axioms of cohomology theory, and it's a very nice cohomology theory, very relevant to the theory of Dirac operators on Riemannian manifolds. Very deep topological results are related to K-theory. Index theory can be viewed as a part of K-theory, in a sense, or you can say that topological K-theory was invented originally, at least partially, in this view of index theory. And it is, in fact, related to the Durham cohomology. So I'm assuming that people are more comfortable with the Durham cohomology than with K-theory. But there is a clear relation between them. In other words, if you ignore the precise quantization of Dirac quantization of charges, and if you ignore the possibility of having torsion classes, things like Z2 charges in that cohomology theory, then the Durham cohomology is the same as K-theory in the sense of this formula. Okay, so in this sense, D-brains can be viewed as topological solitons, which are leftovers of imperfect brain and anti-brain annihilation of a higher dimensional brain system. And you can get a more detailed field theoretical description of this picture by looking at the gauge theory that lives on that world volume of those higher dimensional brains. In particular, if you have N brains and N anti-brains, the gauge symmetry in the simplest scenario will be a UN cross UN gauge symmetry, and there will be a tachyon Higgs field that I've advertised before, which will have the tendency to condense. When it condenses uniformly, this is equivalent to a complete annihilation of the brain anti-brains, and you're left with just an empty space-time, possibly with some radiation going away to infinity. If, however, this Higgs mechanism that breaks UN cross UN down to the UN develops topological defects, that's exactly how you would describe in this language those leftover stable D-brains. So the D-brains that are left over after the annihilation of the original brain anti-brain system are precisely topological defects, solitons in the Higgs field of this particular Higgs breaking pattern. And this can be made more precise. In fact, it was figured out by Ashok Sen, even before the connection to K3 was discovered, that if you have some topological defect in your space, in your space-time system of brains, then its profile with respect to some transverse direction R is not a particularly nice and interesting universal function, but there is a topological winding number which is hiding inside this particular sort of so-called gamma dot X expression. So the way it works is that you have some transverse dimensions xi to your topological defect. So you have some d-dimensional transverse space. You look at the SOD rotation group, write down gamma matrices for that SOD rotation Euclidean group, and using those gamma matrices, you write down this type of ansatz. It's called the gamma dot x construction for obvious reasons. And this is a result due to Sen that the topological defects that describe lower dimensional brains inside higher dimensional brain systems are described precisely by this so-called gamma dot x procedure. An example might be useful. So, sorry? That's the tachyon field, the Higgs field that I mentioned on the previous transparency. It's the field that's condensing, and at the core of the defect, T will be zero, or at least T being a matrix, the determinant of T will be zero, and asymptotically at infinity, it will be sitting in its vacuum manifold of the Higgs mechanism. So one simplest example would be in codimension one. That would be simply just a kink in a scalar field. Obviously, that carries a conserved quantum number in this particular context. In codimension three, you might be looking at some non-abelian structure, because now the gamma matrices that you will need to write down that ansatz will be 2x2 matrices living on a transverse three-dimensional space. And the corresponding defect, the gamma dot x construction in three dimensions, is exactly the same thing as the magnetic monopole of conventional gauge theories. So this is something we recognize as something conventional, but this extends all the way down to potentially an arbitrary number of dimensions. So this is a physical construction. The Higgs condensate of a particular topological form represents a topological defect, but it's also a mathematically well-recognized construction of K-theory, which was actually discovered in 1963, and it's called the Atiyah-Bott-Shapiro construction. So this was way before physicists realized that there is any such thing as a Higgs field, and that there are solitons, and then things could condense. If you go back to that mathematical literature from the early 60s, you find out all the magnetic monopoles and everything already in that paper by Atiyah-Bott and Shapiro implicitly, or at least all the mathematical formulas are there. So if you're a mathematician, this gamma dot x construction is a canonical universal way of representing non-trivial classes inside this K-theory cohomology thing. So physicists rediscovered it using the Sen construction of solitons. So there's one more useful thing to know about K-theory. K-theory is also related to homotopy groups of the group manifold of UN. So this turns out to be a mathematically true statement. If you define K-theory groups the way I did by the equivalence classes of pairs of bundles, then it turns out that that defines for you some groups K of spaces, and you get the same result from looking at corresponding homotopy groups of the UN group manifold. This is a very useful connection to keep in mind. It's also only true when the rank of the UN group that you look at is large enough. So there's a notion of stability. You have to look at a group which has a large enough rank in order to calculate a universal looking homotopy group. So if I want a pi sub p homotopy group, I have to look at n, which is greater than p over 2, and assuming that I'm looking at values of n greater than that, then the homotopy groups are independent of rank of the group. That's a fundamental mathematical fact that defines K-theory. Okay, so let me summarize this kind of string theory, K-theory part of the talk. And you can forget most of what I've said, with the exception of the following. If you imagine having some kind of a stable D brain. So let me visualize it as this yellow higher codimension submanifold in space-time. Then if it's a stable D brain, there's some topology that protects it. There's some quantum number that it carries. And you can measure that quantum number by surrounding the D brain by a K minus one dimensional transverse sphere, SN, which is the, in this cartoon, it's the red line here. And you can measure the winding number inside that Higgs field condensate. And if that quantum number is non-zero, it's a non-zero element of this corresponding homotopy group here, then the brain will be stable as a defect in that Higgs field. And at the same time, unfortunately, the letters here are in black, so you can't quite see them. But at the same time, having said what I said on the previous transparencies, this homotopy group that measures the non-trivial winding number around the D-brain defect is actually the same thing as the K-theory group of the transverse K-dimensional space. So the K-theory group of Rn is the same thing as the K-1st homotopy group of the group manifold UN in which that Higgs field has values. So in that sense, one can identify the charge that's carried by that lower dimensional yellow D-brain here with an element of the K-theory group of the space that's transverse, this white space that cuts through the world volume of the brain in the transverse dimensions. And in that sense, the charge that's measured by that homotopy winding number is, in fact, a charge in K-theory. So what does that imply for the spectrum of brains? Now that we've established this connection to K-theory, you can ask your mathematician friends what the K-theory groups are of various spaces, and you find out that they can calculate K-theory groups of Rn for any n, and there is a nice periodicity by 2, which tells you that you should expect a stable brain in every other dimension, which is exactly what we see in type 2 superstring theories. And in that sense, it's rather boring, because we would say we already knew that the spectrum of D-brains in type 2 string theories has this Bott periodicity built in. We just didn't call it Bott periodicity. It's now just because we appreciate a connection to K-theory that we call it by the name of Bott periodicity, which is the mathematician's term for calculating these K-theory groups. But we already knew the spectrum of brains from previous string theory arguments. So you go and look at the more interesting case of type 1 string theory, which is just a Z2 orientifold of type 2 string theory. And there, the same construction would go through, except your bundles would not be complex bundles, they would be real bundles. So if you use real bundles to define the real version of K-theory, that's called KO theory. And you can also calculate systematically all the K-theory groups for that real K-theory. And you get, again, some periodicity, but now the periodicity is by 8. And you get the integer value charges in dimensions 0, 4, 8, and so on by 4. But also, the novelty is that you now also get torsion charges. You get objects that can carry a Z2 charge. In other words, if two of such stable charged objects are brought together, they are allowed to annihilate because they only carry a Z2 charge and not a full integer valued set of charges. And those exist in dimensions 1, 2, modulo 8, and predict the existence of previously unknown Z2 charged D0, D7, and D8 brains in string theory. And after this discovery of that connection to K-theory, these were all verified as being there without people noticing before. So in that sense, K-theory already is bringing some new physics to string theory that would be very hard to identify without this prior knowledge of the structure of the K-theory groups. So now that we've hopefully established that D-brains are K-theory objects, K-theory is a very subtle, mysterious, generalized cohomology theory, not something that we would typically deal with in physics on a daily basis. So this raises all kinds of puzzles and questions. In particular, makes you wonder whether the objects that D-brains couple to, namely the Ramon-Ramon differential form fields, are they now some mysterious, crazy objects in some obscure K-theory instead of being good old differential forms for which we can write down effective Lagrangians? And the answer is yes, those Ramon-Ramon fields do have to now be interpreted as objects in K-theory. And in fact, we have no clue now how to start writing down Lagrangians for them. And that creates a very puzzling situation to many string theorists. We don't want to give up a nice Lagrangian effective action description of Ramon-Ramon fields. On the other hand, if they are K-theory objects, we have no clue how to write down differential operators on them. And some people actually are working in that particular direction. I think most notably, Dan Fried is working on attempts to define some differential version of K-theory, but that's some extremely high mathematics for me, so I don't really know how far that has progressed so far, but we don't know how to write down Lagrangians. That's the bottom line, that RR fields are something really bizarre and mysterious. It makes you wonder, again, whether this is some subtlety of string theory or whether there are other fields in physics where similar features would be found. So now here comes the condensed matter part. So the condensed matter theorists in the audience can wake up, and string theorists don't have to wake up because I know that string theorists are always alert. So I don't have to remind string theorists to wake up. But, okay. So hopefully you'll keep some information about K-theory from what I've just described, but in principle, you can forget that last half hour, and we can start from scratch by looking at the following physical system. Let's start with something very mundane and down to earth, namely a complex Fermi field, a non-relativistic fermion carrying an index sigma, which is just the spinner index of the transverse rotation SOD group in D non-relativistic spatial dimensions. The novelty here is that I'm not going to be restricting myself to just 3, 2, or 1 space-time dimension, spatial dimensions, because I'm not particularly interested in a realistic physics system right now. I'm essentially in condensed matter in an arbitrary number of dimensions because of the potential connection to the string theory. And then, just for the fun of it, I'll give this field psi also an internal symmetry index, little I, which goes from 1 to some value n, and you can think of it as an SUN fundamental representation or any other of your any favorite group representation you want. And then we'll start with describing the system by some microscopic Lagrangian. So we'll be integrating over d plus 1 dimensions, and we'll have some conventional looking kinetic term for these non-relativistic fermions. There'll be some chemical potential here, and there'll be lots of interaction terms. There could be self-interaction things, maybe a 4 Fermi self-interaction. Maybe there's some interaction with some order parameter in the system. Or maybe there are some impurities that I'm averaging over. There are dots here. Everything is hiding inside these dots. And what I want to understand is how to classify possible universal behaviors in this type of system. So let me remind you of some basic features of Landau's theory of Fermi liquids. And let's start with an elementary example. If that system from the previous transparency were just 3 fermions with no interaction whatsoever, we know exactly how to solve that system. So we'll just write down the ground state, which is in some momentum space. Here I've indicated only 2 momentum dimensions, kx and ky. There'll be some round sphere that's filled up to some Fermi momentum kf. So this is an extremely well-known ground state of the system. And you would like to study perhaps mildly interacting systems in some perturbation theory near this ground state. And since I'm already talking about the ground state of a free system, let me remind you one very well-known but particularly beautiful property of these free non-relativistic fermions. If you look at the example of a 1 plus 1 dimensional system, there is some dispersion relation that relates omega and k. And remember the existence of that Fermi chemical potential for the Fermi surface. What happens is that now if you look at modes, which are the lowest energy modes in the system, they reside in the vicinity of the Fermi surface. The Fermi surface here consists of 2 points, at plus kF and minus kF. And then when you are interested only in the low energy modes of the system, you look at the vicinity of the Fermi points, and you find out that the dispersion relation for these extremely low energy modes becomes relativistic. So you have an emergent relativistic property in 1 plus 1 dimensions. The lowest modes here become relativistic simply because that's the generic behavior of linearizing the dispersion relation near the Fermi points. Again, this is an extremely well-known fact. It's, in my view, very beautiful, even though it's elementary. And we'll see how this generalizes later on for reasons that have to do with K-theory to higher dimensional systems. As I said, there is a relativistic dispersion relation. And for interacting systems, you replace that naive idea of filling up all states up to some Fermi energy with a more sophisticated RG type argument. There are some really great reviews in the literature. I've mentioned the two here that I learned the most from, but there are others which are really interesting. So this has a large history already going all the way back to Landau. And the idea roughly is that if you look at where the lowest mode states, the lowest energetic modes reside, they're not residing as in a relativistic field theory near the origin in the momentum space. Instead, they're residing in the vicinity of the Fermi surface. So instead of assuming too much about the behavior at very high energies, which means out here or somewhere near the origin of phase space, you just assume self-consistently some knowledge of the behavior near the Fermi surface, and you run the normalization group ideology to understand how various perturbations of the system scale under the normalization group. So in other words, you define your scaling in the normalization group sense towards the Fermi surface, indicated here by these red lines. So you integrate out shells in the RG procedure so that you scale towards the Fermi surface and not towards the origin. This, of course, to our condensed matter friends, is a trivial statement, but to relativistic particle physicists, this is a novelty in the normalization group picture. So that's why I'm mentioning it here in this much detail. And this is the logic I want to follow. I want to see what kind of universal systems, universal classes of behavior are possible, given the fact that the scaling is somewhat non-trivial already in this simplest case where the Fermi surface is some co-dimension one surface in momentum space. So when I'm mentioning that this Fermi surface is co-dimension one in momentum space, I should define right now what I mean by a generalized Fermi surface. A generalized Fermi surface would be defined, or will be defined for the rest of the talk, as any submanifold in the momentum frequency space where gapless excitations are supported. So in the simplest case of a nearly free system of fermions, this would be a co-dimension two Fermi surface in the momentum frequency space, or co-dimension one in the momentum space. But you could also have higher co-dimension surfaces supporting gapless excitations. And that's a very useful generalization to keep in mind, because in fact, we want to classify all possibilities and not just the single possibility that looks like a free fermion system. And in particular, I wanted to point out to the string theory side of the audience how amazingly similar Fermi liquids are in spirit in their normalization group properties to our favorite string-inspired RGS system, which is the flow of two-dimensional sigma models, which defines for you string world sheets as they propagate in some Riemannian manifold solving Einstein's equations. The reason why you can solve Einstein's equations using the conform invariance of two-dimensional sigma models is that you have an infinite number of formally marginal deformations of the theory, so you have to work harder to find out what are the exact marginal deformations, and you find a very rich spectrum of possibilities. So in that sense, the Fermi liquids are the only other system I know of, at least, that are equally rich in their normalization group behavior. So I wonder whether already at that level there is some interesting connection between Fermi liquids and what we understand in string theory. Again, I don't have anything very specific to say. Okay, so what we want to do in those Fermi liquids, again, is to look at the stable Fermi surfaces and classify all possibilities. So I've already defined generalized Fermi surfaces on the previous slide. And now I want to decide which ones are stable and which ones are unstable. What do I mean by stability? I define stability by saying that if you have a submanifold in momentum frequency space where gapless excitations live and you perturb the system slightly, two things can happen. Either the gapless excitations become gapped or they stay gapless. And I would call the Fermi surface stable under small perturbations if under any such small perturbation you have to still be stuck with those gapless excitations. In other words, the gapless feature is not lifted by a small deformation. And now my intention is to classify all of them. So let's see how this works in examples which are already known in the literature. If you look at 3+1 dimensional systems, then we have several interesting examples. The free Fermi system, obviously, that's a two-dimensional Fermi surface in the 3+1 dimensional momentum frequency space. If you look at the aphase of helium-3, that's a well-known system where actually there are points of gapless excitations, so you could call them Fermi points or generalized Fermi surfaces of dimension zero. And you can ask the natural question, if I have a Fermi surface which can be a two-sphere, or I can have a Fermi surface which is a point, can I have the intermediate dimension? Can I have a Fermi line in some 3+1 dimensional system? And I'm told by my condensed matter friends that the answer to this question is no. There are no known systems, unless you impose some really weird extra symmetries, which I can comment on later. But generically, you can have stable two-dimensional surfaces of Fermi surfaces, or you can have stable Fermi points, but you cannot have stable Fermi lines. That's intriguing, and you would like to know why that's true. My claim is that these are actual signs of Bach periodicity in Fermi liquids. And I'll try to convince you later that that's really true, because I'll try to show you that stable Fermi surfaces defined in the way I defined them on the previous couple of transparencies are again classified by K-theory just as D-band charges are. Okay, so let's go through some technical simple argument to see the emergence of K-theory from Fermi liquids. And the way I'll do it is the following. I'll look at the inverse propagator for that system of fundamental fermions psi. So these are the microscopic degrees of freedom. And I won't be assuming the knowledge of too much dynamics for this system. The argument will be topological. So that's why I like it particularly, because it's a very robust argument. Shouldn't be sensitive to the microscopic details of the field psi. So I'll look at a two-point function between psi and its complex conjugate. Again, I'm looking at complex fermions. Later on, I'll comment on the situation of real fermions. And you can think of complex fermions, by the way, as a sort of analog of type 2 superstring theory, and real fermions as the analog of type 1 superstrings. So I'll show you more about that in a few slides. But now let's just look at this two-point function. And to simplify, again, sigma is the spin index, and I is some internal index of some symmetry group. So the total number of components carried by this field psi is dimension dependent, but it's always bigger than 2 to the real part of, sorry, the integral part of d over 2, which is an exponentially growing number for larger numbers of dimensions. This numerology here is actually going to be important, because we'll see that this will allow us to prove that we are in the stable regime that defines K-theory. So let's, instead of referring to these pairs of indices, let's have this collective index A that goes over all the possible values together. So this is the matrix which I'm interested in, the inverse propagator of the system. And again, this is some capital N by capital N matrix, where N is some large finite number in principle. The higher the dimension, the larger this dimension becomes, the rank of the field. And what you want to do when you classify all possible stable Fermi surfaces, if you have a Fermi surface, what does that mean? That means that you have a gapless excitation localized there. In other words, the determinant of this inverse propagator better be zero there, because otherwise there is no gapless mode there. So we are trying to classify all possible stable zeros of the determinant of this matrix, stable under small perturbations of the propagator. And small means here that I'm not doing much to the asymptotic behavior at infinity. I'm just slightly perturbing the propagator. So this is clearly a topological problem. And the answer will be the following. Imagine having some candidate Fermi surface, which is here indicated by this green line now. But of course, the picture should be reminding you of the previous picture from D-Brain, from the D-Brain part of the talk, where the line was yellow, but it was just about the only difference. Technically, we have this green line, which is supposed to be the submanifold of gapless excitations in the Fermi liquid. And we are trying to probe whether there's a topological reason for the zero to stay there if you perturb the system a little bit. So the propagator, this matrix, this matrix I had on the previous slide here, this is a capital N by capital N matrix, which outside of the green line should be non-degenerate. So you can think of it as an element of the group GLN, simply because it's an N by N non-degenerate matrix. So again, if I surround the Fermi surface by a codimension 1 sphere of some dimension k minus 1 in the transverse k-dimensional space, the red line here, then if the sphere winds once around some non-trivial cycle inside that group manifold GLN, then there's no way you can perturb the system slightly and get rid of that zero along the green line. So in other words, the Fermi surface will be stable. So you see that the homotopy groups, or almost the same homotopy groups that classify D-brain charges, are now classifying stable Fermi surfaces. Now the only cosmetic difference is that in the case of D-brains, what we had here was UN and not GLN. But then your mathematician friends can again tell you that the homotopy groups of these guys are equal to each other, because UN is the maximal compact subgroup of this guy, and their homotopy groups are the same. So we've established in this relatively simple way, our first result, which is that the stable Fermi surfaces defined on the previous transparencies in Fermi liquids in any number of dimensions would be classified by these case theory groups of the transverse space RK in this particular case. Okay, so this is very similar to the stuff that we saw in D-brains. And the conclusion here is that, again, Bott periodicity will govern the periodic structure of what's stable and what's unstable. And for the case of complex fermions, which I've discussed so far, the Bott periodicity of the K3 groups is by 2. And it proves for us that we have stable Fermi surfaces for odd codimensions and unstable for even codimensions.
Question?
Yes?
In the next letter, you're thinking of the ability of the Fermi surface as like a dynamical question, not a topological question. You think it's just a 3.1
sure.
Right. Channel,
right. That's exactly. Yeah. Okay.
How do you define stability?
Right. Stability. I would differentiate between stability under small and big perturbations. I'm considering here only the stability under small perturbations, and so I'm assuming that the stability under large perturbations, such as superconductivity, is already.
No.
Right. No. What I mean is that there are perturbations that do change the asymptotic behavior of the propagator, like the Cooper-Perrin instability, and there are smaller perturbations still that can only change the local behavior near the Fermi surface. So I'm assuming that the first ones, which are more dramatic instabilities, have already been incorporated, and I'm now looking at the next step, which is the perturbations on the stability on the small perturbations. I understand exactly what you mean. I'm aware of this point, and we can discuss in more detail after the talk. But I can give you the technical definition of a small instability. That would be the instability which keeps the values of the propagator non-degenerate on some sphere. So we can discuss. I'll be happy to discuss the technical aspects of this. Well, for example, you can have an arbitrary fluctuation in that Fermi surface, but right or any. Any bosonic excitations that distorts the shape of the Fermi surface, but if you surround it by in the transverse dimensions by a sufficiently large sphere, there is still a zero somewhere. It just moves around when you deform the Fermi surface, but it doesn't go away. It doesn't become a gap system all of a sudden just because the Fermi surface was displaced a little bit. I'll be happy to discuss the technical aspects of this afterwards, because I want to. The good sign is that I'm already creating some non-trivial disturbances in the condensed matter side of the audience, so I see it as a good sign. Right. If you transfers to the hypothetical Fermi surface. So you want to be zooming in on the Fermi surface by looking at the asymptotics further away from the Fermi surface. You can, again, I'll be happy to, I was told that this was not supposed to be a technical talk, so I don't want to get into the technical discussion of the exact conditions. But, No, I don't think that has to do with whether it's real or there's a one symmetry. But it would take me outside of what I'm trying to establish here as the basic point, and we can discuss what the exact definition technically is or should be, or whether this is extendable to bigger, in my definition, instabilities which can lift the entire gapless. For example, the B phase of helium 3. I'm staying away from here because it's outside of what I'm trying. Anyway, so. Okay, so I was just about to say that, again, Bott periodicity gives us this prediction for the stability by 2. And then one can ask, if you look at the coarse-grained fermions, so I'm, again, assuming that there will be some Fermi surface left over, some perhaps a higher codimension subspace, but still of some gapless excitations. And I'm interested in the low-energy dispersion relation of those gapless modes near that Fermi surface. I'm already near some stable Fermi surface of some dimension. There will be still some fermionic excitations then. And let's call them chi. They'll be carrying some index alpha, which a priori has nothing to do with any of the indices that I've shown you before. So we, as a part of understanding this free fixed point that describes these gapless modes chi, the first thing we need to do is to find out how many values this index alpha goes over. And then we want to determine, as I said, the entire dispersion relation at low energies. But now that we understand that the non-triviality, the topological stability of that Fermi surface is protected precisely by the K-theory class, the particular homotopy group element of that group manifold that I was mentioning previously, we know that K-theory is giving us a universal construction for that topological winding number, namely the Atiyah-Bott-Shapiro construction, which was so crucial for string theory in the construction of D-brain. And the claim is now that this ABS construction will actually determine the universal features of the low-energy dynamics of those modes chi, and in particular will tell us how many important components there are that still contribute to this gapless field. Oops. So these fields chi will be described by some low-energy action. This is some relatively complicated measure in these variables. Let's not discuss exactly what it means. But there's going to be some kinetic operator D that sits in the kinetic term between chi and chi dagger. And determining the low energy dispersion relation is equivalent to determining some leading behavior of this operator D. And just by applying the Atiyah-Bott-Shapiro construction directly, what you get is up to some, again, non-universal and unimportant, uninteresting overall multiplicative function, you get gamma dot p, where p is now all the momentum components, including the frequency in the dimensions transfers to the Fermi surface. So mu is an index that parametrizes those p plus 1 transfers dimensions to the Fermi surface. And this is the dispersion relation as a result of the universality of K-theory. So this actually establishes two other results. The second result is that at low energies, the dispersion relation, this is effectively the dispersion relation for these coarse-grained fermions, is governed by the ABS construction of K-theory. And the third result is that if you stare for 5 seconds at the form of that dispersion relation, it's obviously relativistic in those p plus one dimensions. This is nothing but just the Dirac operator, the relativistic Dirac operator of a massless fermion in p plus one dimensions. So the Atiyah-Bott-Shapiro construction in K-theory predicts that the low-energy coarse-grained fermions, chi, will be exhibiting a relativistic dispersion relation, but now in that p plus one dimensional transfer space to the Fermi surface. And you should notice how, for example, the statistics that a relativistic field theorist might be worried about here is nicely reproduced, because this ABS construction tells us how many fermions will be contributing to the low energy dynamics here, because the gamma matrix that enters here is the gamma matrix of the transverse P plus one dimensional Lorentz group, transverse to the Fermi surface. So we know exactly what the dimension has to be of the space on which the gamma matrix acts. So these fermions, chi, will be equipped with the spinner index, precisely with the spinner index of that transverse SOP plus one dimensional Lorentz group. So that's a nice self-consistency check, because you see that if it's a relativistic theory of low energies, it better satisfy the spin statistics theorem. So one comment on this Atiyah-Bode-Shapiro construction: when people called it the gamma dot X construction, it looked kind of bizarre and strange, and classified non-trivial topological solitons in some complicated string theory. Now we've turned it from something that lives in a physical space into something which lives in momentum space, and that's a much more natural place for the Atiyah-Bode-Shapiro construction, because this gamma dot P is now nothing but just the conventional relativistic Dirac operator, something very familiar to both mathematicians and physicists. And I should point out that here, what it classifies is not some topological solitons, but also already at the level of free fields, classifies all possibilities of what can be stable in the definition that I was using of stability of Fermi surfaces. So now let's look at some other extensions of the story. In particular, if you ask what happens for real fermions, again, it's going to be very similar in pattern to what happens in type 1 superstring theory versus type 2 string theory. So we'll be dealing with some real bundles, and therefore a naive guess might be that it's going to be that real KO theory, which has that bar periodicity by 8, which will be relevant here. But that's slightly too naive and incorrect. It turns out that if you incorporate properly some reality conditions that define real bundles out of complex bundles, that the relevant K theory here is actually something that mathematicians call KR theory. I don't want to get into that. But that has also a periodicity by 8. So let's just summarize the results that we'll get from that KR theory for real fermions. We'll also be able to, just as in the theory of complex fermions, for example, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, we'll have a stable Fermi surface. And there'll be some periodicity of that stability pattern by 4. But there'll be now a novelty of having Z2 charged Fermi surfaces. In other words, let's take an example of that behavior. Let's consider 2 plus 1 dimensions. As far as conventional Z charged Fermi surfaces are concerned, the prediction would be that there could be a stable line, and that would be it. But now we have a Z2. That would be the case for complex fermions. For real fermions, however, you can also have that same stable Fermi line, but there's a possibility of having a stable Fermi point. But it's only stable as long as you don't bring another such same Fermi point close to the original Fermi point, because then they can annihilate each other. And I can give you references of situations in condensed matter literature where people have actually seen this type of behavior for specific 2 plus 1 dimensional systems without seeing the systematics of why such Z2 charged Fermi points should exist, or what's making them stable only if they're apart that allows you to annihilate two of those against each other. I should say that this can be also extended in all kinds of other directions. You can start imposing extra discrete symmetries or extra continuous symmetries, or even extra gauge symmetries can be incorporated into this, and there will be always some kind of a mathematical answer, some kind of a K-theory, which will be the conjectured tool that classifies the stable Fermi surfaces under those symmetry conditions. And I don't want to discuss any technicalities of that type right now. And also you can start extending this from classifying possible Fermi surfaces describing the vacua of systems or the ground states to studying solitons inside those particular universality classes of behavior. And in particular, the simplest scenario for doing that would be to assume that you are in a semi-classical regime where H bar is almost zero, and think of the Fermi surface now as being able to vary not only along the momentum frequency space, but also being varied slowly in the moment in the physical space and time. So as long as you don't go against the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, this will allow you to study topological defects where you have profiles in space, and again, there's a natural extension of K3 that classifies now not only the vacua but also all possible stable solitons within those vacua and gives you dispersion relations for lowest modes on those solitons. This is something that some students at Berkeley are particularly interested in right now, so there might be some results along those lines soon. And also, for those of you who wonder to what extent these solitons would be then similar or not so similar to D-brains, let me start by just mentioning that Fermi surfaces can be argued to carry an effective tension. And if you have a soliton which is made out of allowing the Fermi surface to have a profile in space that makes it into a solitonic excitation, then you can start calculating the tensions and studying whether those solitons support some string-like excitations. I have no result along those lines or any intuition whether these solitons inside Fermi liquids will be behaving like or unlike D-brains. So let's wrap up the colloquium by going back to string theory and pointing out that there are already in string theory several instances where non-relativistic fermions have appeared, and some of them are the old matrix models of the early 90s, where matrix quantum mechanics of some large N matrices has been studied and proposed as a discretization of 1 plus 1 dimensional worksheets of strings living in 1 plus 1 dimensions. That's a huge subject in terms of the number of papers and review papers, so I didn't even start putting any references here. The fermions there, the non-relativistic fermions there, emerge as eigenvalues of the matrices and give rise to the spatial dimension of a 1 plus 1 dimensional string theory. So that's a beautiful connection to non-relativistic fermions. In fact, the non-relativistic fermions are the best and only non-perturbative definition of what we mean by 1 plus 1 dimensional string theory in that context. So instead of defining string theory as a theory of quantum gravity, you start by saying string theory is non-perturbatively defined as a theory of 1 plus 1 dimensional non-relativistic fermions, and from there you derive all the gravitational properties on the other side, or at least try to, because sometimes it's very difficult. Now, the novel understanding of all matrix models that's been accumulated over the last 5 or so years, or maybe less, is that the fermions which enter into these old matrix models should naturally be and are naturally interpreted as unstable D0 brains of the string theory. So that's a very explicit connection between non-relativistic fermions and D-brains that's been already sitting there inside these old matrix models. Now, there is another very interesting recent development when you look at half-BPS states in ADS-CFT, in particular ADS-5 plus S5 versus four-dimensional super-Young-Mills. Then, in that particular sector, for some fixed charges and after some dust settles, the conformal field theory can be reduced also to a matrix model. And again, the eigenvalues of those matrices will be again fermions and will correspond when you trace back their origin to the original N, the three brains used to derive the ADS-CFT correspondence. So you can now view supergravity solutions as being seeded in some technical sense by Fermi droplets in some auxiliary two-dimensional phase space-like slice within that condensed matter system, within that, relativistic supergravity system. And some references are here. LLM means Lin-Lunin-Maldacena. And the question is whether this connection extends beyond 1 plus 1 dimensional fermions. To my knowledge, there haven't been any instances in string theory where real, honest, higher dimensional non-relativistic Fermi systems would emerge and be compared to brains, but I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility. So my conclusions are threefold. First of all, for condensed matter physics, I hope that after the colloquium I'll be able to convince the condensed matter friends in the audience that this might be a useful tool for condensed matter system, and that this is indeed a classification tool for systematically understanding which Fermi surfaces of one dimension could be stable in a given system. This could be also potentially relevant to the ideas of topological order, which have been developed over the years primarily by people like Wen and Tony Z here. And it will be very interesting to see whether K-theory is the proper mathematical tool for understanding what replaces the conventional notion of symmetry breaking in the order parameter story in that particular set of condensed matter systems. The intriguing possibilities for string theory, I leave to your imagination because I don't really have much specific stuff to say, but it's staggering how similar the structures are to me. And for quantum field theory, I think there's an interesting morale for this from this story. The topology is not only important once you start introducing unperturbative complicated solitons and instantons. It in fact appears for non-relativistic fermions already when you are trying to classify all possible free field fixed points of the RG. And that's an interesting story that you can explain to your quantum field theory class, which I tried this spring with some reasonable success. So it was a lot of fun to the students to see that topology is something that's becoming very important very early on in quantum field theory, not only when you deal with some non-perturbative phenomena. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you. But there are simplifying assumptions, right? But they're layered, so they are effectively. Right. So it's a different. It's on that list of other possibilities of systems which have an extra symmetry or an extra identification, an extra orbifold action. And I can tell you which K-theory group to calculate to get the result. It's certainly not the naive K-theory group that appeared on the transparency. It's going to be something more sophisticated. I bet it'll give you the right charge that is carried by your stable object. If you have a stable object, I guarantee you that there'll be a K-theory charge for it in that particular context. I know in that particular case, because I think we discussed it at Berkeley with our condensed matter theorists, they came up with the same example and they were curious to see whether there is any stability that protects that from the point of view of K-theory. I think so. I think they're very intimately connected. So it could be that your argument, even though it doesn't say the words K-theory, it could be a K-theory argument implicitly. If you ask a mathematician, they could identify it as a K-theory argument. So I think there are some really interesting parallels in your work with this story here. All subgroups of the audience have been equally unhappy about that.
Okay. Well, thank you.